This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we interview Clifton Hicks, an activist in the Iraqi Veterans Against the War. Hicks is currently disabled and enrolled as an anthropology student at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. Appalachian State is a center for old-time music, and Cliff is also an accomplished and well-known banjo player. Cliff is psychologically disabled and got out of the war with an honorable discharge as a conscientious objector several years ago.
Stay with us.
Heidi, it's getting a little unbearable, actually, what happens at all of the demonstrations, whether it's at the RNC or G20s, in terms of what they're doing to protesters. And the latest, of course, takes place in Toronto, and there was a G20 there a couple of weeks ago. So what happened at the G20 and what's going on now?
I wasn't at the G20, Michael. And
How come, Heidi? You've been at every other one.
I wanted to go to this one,
sure.
But I read the reports.
I know you like Canadian food.
I've actually never been to Canada. The reason I didn't go is I read about the amount of money that the police were pouring into security for this, and I heard it was going to be an especially violent, in terms of police presence, what we call in the United States National Special Security Event. And the G20s, the G8s, those are designated NSSEs, which means essentially that the Secret Service is calling the shots. Then they bring in all other kind jurisdictions of police. But
now, the number
Service.
I heard was $1 billion for security at this thing. Is that right?
I heard that.
Seems
too.
Impossible to me.
Well, you know, they bring in private security contracting agencies, military forces. It's really an orchestration of great force, as it were.
Something like 30,000 cops, I understand.
Exactly.
That's a lot of cops. So you got to feed them and pay for them and then,
that's
know, et cetera,
right.
Anyway.
But what happened was over 1,000 people were arrested from June 18th until the two-day summit ended on June 27th. Many of the people arrested, and we see this all the time, said they weren't even participating in the protesters, so they were swept up. Only 263 of these were charged with anything more serious than breach of the peace. And we all know that breach of the peace is one of those sort of catch-all offenses that protesters often get charged with.
Essentially, it's an unconstitutional crime because it's vague and allows the cops to arrest people for any reason they want. I don't think it really can be sustained in the U.S., for example.
Exactly. What happened is Amnesty International's Toronto chapter has called for an independent review of the police conduct there. In addition, some people are apparently quite upset that their chief, Bill Blair of the Toronto Police Service, they say he lied about being able to detain people who didn't consent to showing ID or who didn't consent to being searched if they came within 5 meters of the outside of the G20 security fence.
They couldn't get within about 15 feet even of the fence.
Exactly. And the fence went all around the Metro Toronto Convention Center as well as several other buildings that were, you know, key to the summit. And we've seen this. We saw this at the G20 in Pittsburgh in September 2009. We were seeing a lot of fences going up around perimeters to basically lock people out of very major downtown sections.
So I don't understand.
He
basically said to the police that they could arrest people if they didn't consent to showing ID or being searched. I'm trying to understand.
He told people that police could detain them if they didn't consent to show ID or being searched if they came that close.
And they don't actually have that power. Is that the point? The police don't have that power in Canada.
It turns out that there are no such special powers under their Public Works Act. Blair never told the public. He never corrected his statement, of course, until after the summit ended.
So everybody got arrested illegally.
That's what it
appears. Or detained illegally.
Yeah, as we see par for the course. Charges will be dropped, but we won't really hear about that as much.
What else is new? I mean, this is the RNC in New York when they just cage people, the RNC in Minneapolis. This is the story of protest today in the West.
And let me just end on this note. Apparently, some people up there took to calling the temporary detention center
Torrentanamo Bay. When we had Guantanamo in the Hudson during the RNC, now we have Torrentanamo Bay up in Canada. Thank you, Heidi.
Michael, Michael, we haven't had an update on what's happening in Guantanamo and basic accountability in a while.
Well, one reason we don't have updates, at least with regard to accountability, is because this country still is like an ostrich with its head in the ground, and it doesn't want to see the torture that's in front of it, including our fine president, Obama. But things look like they're a little different in England. And what's interesting in England and the UK is their prime minister, who is not a liberal, who's conservative, they have a new government, has now done two interesting things. One, of course, is the report on Bloody Sunday, the killings during demonstrations in the UK, or in actually in Ireland, of protesters, and that they issued a 50,000-word report and just condemned it. And this conservative prime minister went on and said, we will hold these people accountable. This is necessary to protect our own reputation of our soldiers and our police. And then a few days ago, he went on and he said, we are going to open investigations of the torture and the allegations made by Guantanamo detainees who have sued the British government and others subject to rendition, and we're going to look into it. Now, we caged the statement, of course, with all kinds of words about how we love our security services and they do great work, but he said, because we love them so much, we have to make sure that they're essentially really doing a job within the law. And what he said in that statement went beyond that. He said, we will begin the investigation as soon as we are able to settle or dispose of the cases that have been brought against our people in the UK. He implied that they're going to start settling for damages, the Guantanamo cases that have been brought against the UK.
Now, Michael, roughly how many cases are those?
I think there's over a half a dozen, probably seven Guantanamo detainees. There's some rendition cases. Now, we also said British people weren't accused of actually doing the torture. What they did was they often, or sometimes it appears, witnessed other people doing the torture. And he considered that to be highly culpable, assuming those accusations are true. He didn't say whether we know any of them are true, but he did say we're going to be settling these cases. So here you have the spectacle of a firm U.S. ally, in fact, what people would call, they called Bush's poodle, and then formerly it was would have been maybe Obama's poodle, but they're not acting very poodle-like. Heidi's going rough, rough. But they're not acting very poodle-like, and they're actually opening an investigation which could have even wide implications because on some of this stuff they were very cooperative with the United States. So it's just a demonstration to me of how incredibly out of step and how outrageous it is that the U.S. continues to act as if torture is off the page in terms of any investigation of those deeply involved in the torture conspiracy in the United States.
It would be amazing if those trials started soon. And those trials will be the equivalent to our civilian trials?
Well, there's first going to be an investigation. I mean, there are trials going on in the sense that there's been cases brought against British intelligence and various other British officials, but they're going to try and settle those cases. And then because he wants to expedite the investigation into the security forces. So the question is, what is going on here? First, they do the Bloody Sunday report, and now they do this on torture. Is this just an effort of the conservatives, or is that part of it, to embarrass the former Labour government, which had its hands deeply in torture? You also have to remember the Labour government did not release or refused to release the Bloody Sunday report, and it again took the conservatives to do it. So maybe there's politics at play here, but however it got to this result, and of course we have to wait and to see the final results, this is a huge step forward for a Western country, so-called poodle of the United States, to actually take this action.
Jim Lafferty, you're the head of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles. You've been very active in the anti-war movement, and you're one of the sponsors and builders of the anti-war conference that's coming up July 22nd in Albany. Tell us about it, because we'd like to encourage our listeners to attend it.
Well, and they're all warmly invited to attend, I assure you. Over 31 groups have endorsed this conference, including the Iraqi Vets, the National Lawyers Guild, Code Pink, Cindy Sheehan. Noam Chomsky is going to be the keynote speaker at this conference. All of your listeners, of course, can find out more about it by going to either www.noac.org or they can go to nationalassembly.org. Either one will tell them how they can register, all about the many workshops. This is a decision-making body. This is calling together most of the main forces of the anti-war movement to plan massive actions next spring and in the fall actions demanding out now, of course, from Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan. It's an open conference. All who attend get a vote and a voice, and we're very excited about it. Hundreds of people have signed up already. We think it's going to be quite large. We surely hope that out of that conference will come the kind of unity and the kind of power that the mass action movement needs if we're going to finally get us out of these longest American wars.
Jim Lafferty, thank you very much. I'll see you at the conference. Give us that website one more time.
Absolutely. www.noac.org or www.nationalassembly.org. Either one.
Today, we interview Clifton Hicks, an activist in the Iraqi Veterans Against the War. Hicks is currently disabled and enrolled as an anthropology student at Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina. Appalachian State is a center for old-time music, and Cliff is also an accomplished and well-known banjo player. Cliff is psychologically disabled and got out of the war with an honorable discharge as a conscientious objector several years ago. In the spring issue of The Veteran, published by Vietnam Veterans Against the War, there's printed the following chant, which is repeated by soldiers in training to go to Iraq. I went down to the market where all the people shop. I pulled out my machete and I began to chop. I went down to the park where all the children play. I took out my machine gun and I began to spray. This is the kind of psychological brutalization that our young men are forced to endure, and which turns them into creatures that they never thought they'd become, and which gives them memories they can't live with when they come back. Clifton Hicks, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Well, we're sitting here on the third floor above the fabulous Jalopy Theater in Red Hook, Brooklyn. The second annual Brooklyn Folk Festival is going on. You are going to be performing tonight. But I wanted to ask you not just about your career as a musician, Cliff, but also what you did over in Iraq and your activities in Iraq Veterans Against the War. How old were you when you went over to Iraq, and why did you go over there?
I was 18 when I actually got over there. I was 17 when I enlisted. My mom had to sign a consent form so I could go. You know, by the time I actually got over there, I was 18. And why did I go, you ask? You know, there's the typical young male's reaction to the whole 9/11 deal. That was a big deal. I was in ninth grade when that happened, and I was in school, watched all that go down. I had that old cliche patriotic kind of notions going where I was watching the invasion. I had seen the invasion on the news and was reading about it in 03. And I saw guys fighting in Afghanistan in 02 prior to that. And I was still too young to go. I was only, I believe I was only 16 in 02. So I couldn't go. And I was one of the kids that actually called the recruiters up at 16 or 15 and asked them what I could do to like get in. And of course, there was no way to get in. But so by the time I was old enough, I just went. And at the time, I think I remember I really felt like empathy for dudes over there who were fighting, and I felt like I should be over there too, really.
Why did you go? Did you think that Iraq had something to do with 9/11?
Yeah, I sure did. Yeah, I didn't think about it. You know, looking back, it's hard to sort out the thoughts that were going through my mind or the lack of thoughts that were going through my mind. But I was just a typical white Southern kid, or just a typical kid in general. And I saw Arabic people, Muslim people, and sort of figured that they were all in cahoots and they were all out to get us, kind of thing, really.
Was it newspaper reports or TV reports that led you to believe, because it was quite consciously done on the part of the Bush-Cheney administration to mislead people into thinking that Iraq had something to do with 9/11. Was it the mass media that influenced you?
There was probably an influence from mass media. I listened to a lot of AM radio, a lot of daytime AM right-wing radio. Both my parents, and I got two sisters, and my whole family is a bunch of, they're all very open-minded, sort of liberal, you know, nice folks. And I was real rebellious and black sheep as a kid, and I was real, real heavily right-wing and conservative in a lot of ways, or so I thought. And so I would, at that time I was skipping school a lot. I actually got expelled from high school for skipping so much. And I was staying home and playing banjo by myself. And I was listening to, I actually spent a lot of time listening to these right-wing AM talk radio shows. I wouldn't say that that in, the main thing that influenced me was just that I knew there was guys over there who were fighting, and I wanted to pitch in.
Yeah, and be there and kind of help them out, right?
And I also wanted to experience war and adventure, and, you know, I was a kid.
Well, that leads me to my second question. You got over there. Now you're, what, 17, 18 years old. Where did you go? Where did they deploy you? What sorts of things started you thinking about maybe you shouldn't be there?
Well, I actually tried to join the Navy first, because when it actually came down to it, I decided maybe it would be a little better to be in the Navy, be a little wiser and safer, and maybe actually learn something I could use later in life.
You know, my father was in the Marine Corps. Cause he tried to enlist in the Navy because his uncle told him that if you're in the Navy, you always have a bed. And so he went down to enlist in the Navy, and some Marine Corps guy during the Second World War snatched him up and put him in the Marine Corps, which is like the most dangerous thing, and he never had a bed.
That's sort of like what happened to me. I went to the Navy, and they basically laughed me out of there because I was a high school dropout. I had a homeschool diploma, and they suggested that I go next door to the Army, and I was feeling downtrodden, and it was just started to rain as I left the recruiter station, and my dreams were dashed, and I was dragging my feet, and this Hispanic Army recruiter guy comes running out and says, "Hey man, come on in. He was real friendly anyhow, so he got me, and I wanted to go combat arms from the start. I figured if I was going to be in the Army, I wanted to fight, so I went and joined in the cavalry branch in armor as a tank crewman. So I went to Fort Knox, trained on tanks, and then I requested Germany, and I got that. And so I was sent to Germany, and I was sent to the 1st Armored Division. When I got to the 1st Armored Division in Germany near Hanau, they were already deployed. They'd been deployed since May of 03, just a couple months after the invasion. They came in right behind the 3rd Infantry Division, who were the guys that captured Baghdad. My unit came in right after them. And I was a replacement. I came in after that. My feet were on the ground in Iraq in October 03. And I was in Baghdad. And I was in a cavalry squadron. And I was a tank driver. We got Humvees. So they put me on the 50 caliber machine gun on the Humvee. And I weighed about 135 pounds. And I remember when I first got there, I didn't have the upper body strength to actually mount the machine gun on the Humvee or to pull the charging handle back and load it. So my NCOs and my buddies had to mount the machine gun for me and load it for me until I got strong enough to where I could do it on my own. And that's what I was doing, did a lot of that. And then eventually the vehicles got so worn out, especially the tanks, that they switched contractors where they got some of the parts from, I believe, was the story. And we got shoddy parts for the tanks, believe it or not. Surprise, surprise. And the tanks started breaking down real bad. We quit taking the tanks out. They gave us Humvees. And then they wanted more. We realized we needed to be on foot, and they taught us how to do infantry stuff. And so I was a tanker, and I became infantry, which was sort of a nightmare of mine. I wanted to be in a tank, and I didn't want to be in a Humvee, and I didn't want to be on foot. And then I did some where I was a dismount on the back of a Bradley, which is a sort of a fast scouting, smaller tank that you ride in the back of and guys can jump out real quick. We did all that stuff. We did a lot of patrolling, house raids, a lot of guard duty, a lot of heavy mechanical work on the tanks.
How did your attitude change, not just about the war, but about the Iraqi people?
Yeah, when I first got there, you know, I had this whole opinion. I was toeing the party line, just like everybody was. We didn't think we were going to be there for long. And actually, my biggest disappointment was that I had missed the invasion. I felt like the war was over. I'd missed it. We'd won. And I was just going to do, like, police duty, basically, which is mostly what I did. I felt like a liberator, like I had helped these folks out and wanted to continue helping them. And really, I've always been a pretty good kid, you know, even back then. And I had pretty positive feelings about it, and I was very nice to people, and I'm very polite, and did all that I could, but it started to wear on me. And then my buddies who'd already been there for 6 months by the time I got there, they were pretty nasty set. I mean, these are great guys, wonderful, wonderful boys, every one of them. But they had got pretty nasty from being over there. So
nasty not to each other, but nasty to the civilians whose country they were occupying.
Yeah, just, well, because, you know, and there's a reason for that. Guys get nasty because their friends get killed, and you realize that you really can't trust anybody and that nobody wants you to be there. But you're stuck there, and you're sort of like the grit between the sole of the boot and the ground. I mean, you're just getting ground up in the middle of it with them. It's them or you. In many, many cases. And so the way that you get over that is becoming a very callous young man. And so I wasn't like that when I first got there. But after a few months, it wore on me. I saw a couple people get killed and stuff, and nasty things happen. And I just got to where I just hated every last one of them to death.
Well, you started thinking when you went over there that you were a liberator. And now it seems like your thinking has changed.
Yeah, the thinking changed. Well, my first day in Iraq, I didn't even realize it, but I almost died flying into Baghdad. They shot a rocket at our plane as we were coming down on the runway at the Baghdad, at BIOP, the international airport. And coincidentally, I was stationed right near there. But anyhow, and I didn't even know what had happened. We banked real sharp, and apparently they'd shot a rocket at us. So they almost killed me before I even got on the ground. I didn't, you know, whatever. Kept going. Wasn't really scared. And then heard gunfire right off, you know, every day. The first few days I was there, you could hear battles going on outside the wire and stuff. And then my first day at my unit, which was a couple weeks after some ramshackle training they run you through, I was out in the motor pool and they were showing me the tanks. And all of a sudden you hear this, you know, over you, and it's a mortar flying right over us, and it blew up behind us on this hill. And that was my first day at my unit. So it was apparent to me from the beginning that I could very easily be killed. But I felt invincible and stuff. But I didn't think anything would happen to me. Nothing did, fortunately. But, yeah, so the thinking turns from this highfalutin, I'm going to charge in on my white horse and protect these people and kill the bad guys and this, that, and the other. And you realize that it's a whole lot muckier than that. And that there's actually, you know, quite a few good people who are trying to kill you, too, for good reasons. But, I mean, just my reaction after a few months was just to get real nasty like my buddies, you know. There was a turning point in that where we were walking down the street doing some patrol, heard a bunch of gunfire up ahead of us. Every time we heard something like that, we raced up to get into the fray. We were eager to get into some kind of action. We raced up there and ran up there, and it was these neighbors across the street from each other having sort of a family dispute, and they had been shooting at each other. And it was just typical stuff that we just thought was really idiotic. You know, somebody had stolen something from somebody, and it was just ridiculous. They weren't insurgents. But we were mad, and we were scared, so we got tough on them. And we drag all the men out, and we decide we're going to raid their house, even though they're obviously not insurgents. But we're going to raid your house just to get back at you for being assholes, basically. I don't know if I can say that.
We'll bloop it out.
Anyhow, so we raid their house, and I was this, you know, the young, scrawny kid. So they left me outside to guard the prisoners, which was totally, you know, not really SOP. This is before we had really been trained how to do this. And they left me alone outside the house to guard. Really, it was just this one guy who had bucked up to our lieutenant and had pushed our lieutenant. And so we all jumped him and beat his ass and hogtied him and tied him. Then we zipper stripped him to a pole, left me to guard this guy. And I was alone. And then a crowd gathers around me, people who could easily just rip me apart or disappear me. So I'm horrified. And they're jeering at me and saying whatever they say. And, you know, some of the young Muslim dudes will, like, blow kisses at you as, like, a real derogatory, like, homosexual insult kind of thing. They're doing that to me. I'm freaking out. And this guy is yelling, and he's talking to everybody. And I don't know what he's saying. And people are talking to him. So I got scared, and I kept telling him to shut up, and he wouldn't shut up. And long story short, I beat the tar out of him because he wouldn't be quiet. And so here's a POW, you know, cuffed, you know, defenseless. But I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know what he was saying. Maybe he was instructing people to, like, kill me or something. So I was horrified. I beat him pretty bad with my gun. I kept my butt of my rifle tied to my vest, so I couldn't butt stroke anybody, but you could really jab him really good with the muzzle. So I jabbed him real bad and kicked him a bunch, and he was pretty beat up. But when I got out, everybody congratulated me, and they were like, oh, you finally got tough, you know. So there was just stuff like that. But, and at the same time, looking back, a lot of people, you know, tear me down and stuff and say that I'm trying to besmirch the name of the American fighting man or something, but it's just not the case. I'm just trying to explain, you know, these things. This is what, if you put people in that situation, there's nothing else we can do but freak out and hurt people and be nasty to try to persevere and save our own hides.
When did you start talking about the war in Iraq as not a just war and something that you opposed. Did that happen to you while you're still over there?
Well, from the get-go, the feeling from everybody, all the officers, all the NCOs, all the privates, everybody was dead certain that no good was going to come of this. We were wasting our time. It wasn't a real war, and it was a waste of lives and resources. Everybody kind of knew it was a joke.
Well, why'd you think that?
That was just the prevailing notion. I mean, day in and day out, when you go out on patrols and you're doing nothing, and they've got you handing out candy to kids one day, like literally they'd give us like candy and like toys and stuff and go to a school and hand it out. And the next day, you know, you're riding around and you see a bunch of kids get shot, you know. And it was just, this is pointless. We're lying. We're putting on a face. It just seemed very un-American to all of us. And it wasn't what we signed up for. We signed up to hop in tanks, to charge across the desert, to destroy armored divisions and to fight soldiers and to defeat armies and to, you know, to do all this stuff. And it wasn't what any of us signed up for. And we were disappointed. We were angry. And there was nobody to take it out on but the Iraqis. It was just, the whole thing was just a joke. It was blatantly a scam. Everything was a scam over there. It was like this massive commercial scam. You would get a bunch of funds to get generators for a neighborhood, and you'd give generators to a neighborhood, and you'd come back the next week, and the generators would have been stolen by somebody, and nobody cared. On paper, it said that community had electricity, but they didn't, kind of thing. This stuff went on all over the place, and we never did anything that was of any importance, except negatively. You know, we altered people's lives for the worse, never for the better.
Well, did you start thinking about what the real reasons, as opposed to the stated reasons, but what the real reasons were for the United States going into Iraq?
I mean, really, on the ground, you're horrified, you're living day to day. None of that, you know, the whole cliche about you're just fighting for survival, it really is true. I mean, we didn't really have a lot of time to sit around and think about it, and if you did sit around and think about it, you'd drive yourself crazy, which some guys did. The real major turning point for me was a selfish one. It was when the Army really screwed us over. It wasn't until then that I admitted to myself all these things, and a lot of guys did, all these things that had been brewing inside of our minds for so many months. And that was when our time was up, our 12-month stint was up. And we were back in Kuwait. We had our rifles wrapped in plastic. You know, we had every ounce of dust scrubbed off the tanks. Everything was ready to go back to Germany. Something like 25% of our unit, the married guys with families and kids, were already back in Germany. They sent them as the advance party. And so they're back with their families and their kids. And we're in Kuwait. Couple of platoons and stuff are still behind. The infantry guys are bringing up the rear on the way back out of Iraq. We're going home. We're happy. And then that's when this Muqtada al-Sadr guy has this army, this Mahdi army. And they're over in Sadr City, and there's this Abu Ghraib, which is a town between Baghdad and Fallujah, I think. They had a big uprising. This is April 2004, and they killed something like 137 Americans in April. Most of that occurred over a two-week period in the beginning, I think. And when we left Iraq, all this started to happen. Basically, what we didn't realize was as soon as we pulled out and 1st Cavalry Division came in to replace us, they jumped them because they were new guys. And everybody thought the war was over. I mean, that's what was the prevailing feeling. February 2004 was something like 30 guys got killed. It was the quietest month that we had seen since the beginning of the invasion. Nothing happened in February. March was a joke. And so we left. We thought it was over. We thought these guys were going to be bored stiff. And their mission coming in, you know, they were totally unprepared. From what we heard, they were totally unprepared for any kind of a major war situation. And so when we left, 1st Cavalry Division came in. They literally basically had their pants down. And so Sadr's boys jumped them. They overran lots of, you know, Baghdad, Fallujah. That's when they hung those contractors and burned them, those Blackwater guys. All this mess took place. And the Army, at the drop of a hat, after being out there for 12 months, slugging it out, miserable, we were dressed in rags. We were the color of the bricks on this wall here from being out in the sun. We were tired, and we wanted to go back to Germany. They just flipped us right around and sent us back into this war zone, ripped these guys away from their kids and their families, and sent them back. And the 1st Armored Division became the first group of American soldiers since World War II to be deployed in combat for longer than 13 months. My division was out there for 16 months. I was only out there for 10. I was a replacement. But 16 months, that's unacceptable. Maybe if we're fighting fascism, or if, you know, the Red Chinese have landed in California, sure, let's go back. But for this garbage, they're sending us back. And by that time, we'd already seen the holes. We'd poked the holes in the thing. We'd seen it all. We knew it was garbage. We knew it was a joke. And we had just been, we'd had our eye on the prize. We said, come April, we're going home. We can do, you know, we can make it. Let's just get out of here. We weren't thinking past that. And when they took that away from us, and they sent us back into this joke war zone to do the bidding of a bunch of these fat back in the States who are don't give a damn about any of us, a lot of people just lost it. And that's when I lost it. And I didn't play anymore. I wasn't going to play anymore. I wasn't going to do it. Anyhow, that was my major turning point. It was a selfish one. But that's when I had a big change of heart, and it affected me so that I was able to step back and look at it all and realize that this was just a giant scam, and that there was no reason for us to be there, and that they were throwing our lives away.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
He's 5'2" and he's 6'4". He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Lobau? Without him, Caesar would have stood alone. He's the one who gives his body as a weapon of the war, and without him all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from here and there, and you and me, and brothers, can't you see?
We're speaking with Cliff Hicks here at the Brooklyn Folk Fest. He's a musician as well as an anti-war activist in North Carolina. Tell us about what happened when you got back to the States, Cliff.
That's sort of a mixed-up story. I started to become an anti-war activist when I was still in the Army. What happened in Iraq after we got back, I mentioned that I had this, I sort of just lost it, as did a lot of people. I tried to get a bunch of guys in Kuwait to mutiny with me and to just not go back. That was a joke. Nobody wanted to do that. So I said, all right, well, I guess we'll go back. We went back. And then when we went back, I just continued to display myself as not wanting to fight anymore, and not being any kind of real soldier anymore. So they tried to give me a break. They just sort of put me as a dismount on a Bradley, which they considered a vacation. So I was dismount on a Bradley, and I later found out that we did that for like 2 months or something. We rode around in those things in this part of this busted up town. I don't remember it. It was just a blur for me. Anyhow, but I kept running my mouth and kept speaking out against stuff, and eventually I was able to walk about a mile and a half, maybe 2 miles, and get to this place where they had internet, where there was this civilians posted, and I had a blog going. And I was posting stuff up there, a lot of politicals, not really political, but just, I was just telling people what was going on, that this was terrible, and that the soldiers were not happy. I had seen on the news at some R&R place, I had seen on the news where they'd interviewed a bunch of senior NCOs and officers from our division about what they thought about, you know, us being redeployed and sent back into the war. And they, you know, were just like, well, you know, we got to do our job. And they were smiling and, you know, we're happy to do our duty and this, that, and the other. And I was disgusted. They blatantly hadn't interviewed any of us, you know. And then I saw, you know, and so I was harping on, I wanted everybody to know that we weren't happy, we didn't want to be here, and we were against it. And then there was another thing where, like, while we were out on a mission, they took a bunch of cooks and mechanics and, you know, pencil pushers and clerks and stuff, put them on our tanks, gave them American flags to wave, and took a bunch of pictures of them and interviewed a few of them, sitting on our filthy, rusty, bloodstained tanks. And we came in off of like a two-day mission and saw that, and there was nothing we could do. You know, your relationship to your tank is pretty, runs fairly deep. And to see these spoon jockeys and these pencil pushers on our tanks waving miniature flags, being interviewed and giving shout-outs to people back home and stuff. You know, nobody was claiming that they were tankers or cavalrymen, but that was insinuated. The people back home see these, you know, so the stuff like that. We started to see this facade. We were being used, and blatantly, they would never have put our whole troop on our tanks and given us little flags and had us talk. Because first of all, we were dressed in rags, we were filthy, and we didn't know how to speak without swearing, and we would have just screwed with the reporters and, like, you know, and just been terrible and cussed and probably would have gotten in a lot of trouble. And so anyhow, the stuff like this continued to go on. I couldn't believe that this stuff was going on. So anyhow, I started to run my mouth and tell stuff about this. And then I started to get really vocal on the blog. And I said things like, F General Abizade, who was the whole commander of the central army there in the Middle East. So General Abizade, I said, you know, F him and F George Bush, and basically called my entire chain of command a bunch of cowards and liars and traitors, and that if, and I mentioned that thing about those guys on the tank, and, you know, that, you know, if all, we'd like to spit in the president's face and this, that, and the other. So come to find out, the whole thing was monitored the whole time. And I got woke up one morning with a boot to my cot and a big stack of paper, and I knew right away, and it had highlighting all over it where I'd violated regulations, and I knew, and it was my section sergeant, my platoon leader, and my the gunner on my tank. My entire, you know, immediate chain of command were there, and they kicked me awake, and I was, you know, naked, basically, and I jumped up to attention, you know. Well, the first thing I did was, when I saw these guys, was I looked for my pistol, which I always had hung over my wall, because I'm thinking maybe they've come to strangle me or something. And so they snuck in while I was asleep and took my rifle and my gun away from me. And they kicked my cot and woke me up and threw these papers on me and said, "We got you, you know, for like treason and stuff, and you're going to go to prison and this, that, and the other." So I'm up, I'm standing, you know, basically naked at attention here. And anyhow, so I got in a lot of trouble. And I got busted back down to private and fined, and they took my weapons away from me and this, that, and the other. And that's when I basically severed myself from the Army. And I just continued to speak openly at that point. And I got real savvy with the Army legal system and the way things operated. And so I managed to weasel my way into this headquarters job where I basically was just, it was funny, they had busted me for OPSEC violations, because apparently one of my charges was operational security violations. Apparently they were claiming that I was making it look like I was like leaking secrets to the insurgents. Or that's what they tried to make it out as. But anyhow, all I was doing was telling what we were doing. But they put me right in the headquarters vehicle on the map and the radios. So I was right in there doing all that. And I got to be friendly with officers and high-ranking NCOs. And I got to, you know, I made myself a little more comfortable and was able to sit back and think about things. Anyhow, so I actually had I did an interview for these guys called Military Counseling Network over in Germany. It's a Mennonite organization that helps guys go through the conscientious objector process, or if you've gone AWOL, they'll help you with that, this, that, and the other. So I did an interview with them. I had to sneak them onto the barracks because I was confined to post for months. And so I did my first anti-war interview as an active soldier in the Army in my barracks in Germany in 04. And that was while when I got back to Germany, I basically, there's a lot of details to this, but I applied to be a conscientious objector. There was an 8-month investigation where they interviewed everybody, interviewed me, and tore me apart and tried to get me in trouble and get me kicked out other ways. And eventually I was honorably discharged. So when I came home, I was ready to jump into the anti-war movement.
And you came back to North Carolina?
I'm a Floridian originally. So I came back to Florida. And there was nothing going on in Tampa, so I left Tampa and I went up to Gainesville, Florida. And in Gainesville, Florida, I was able to get up and get a couple members together. We started an Iraq Veterans Against the War chapter in Gainesville, and I guess I was the chapter president, and there was a Veterans for Peace chapter there, which was headed by Scott Camille, Scott Camille was a big name in the anti-war movement, especially back in the 70s when he came home from Vietnam. He was one of the original Winter Soldier testifiers. Anyhow, so I got under the wing of Scott Camille down in Gainesville, and we started this chapter, and I did a bunch of speaking. We spoke at UF, we spoke at, University of Central Florida, I've spoken at University of South Carolina. I got flown out to Berlin and spoke over at Humboldt University. Basically did a lot of speaking, and we did some rallies and stuff like that, and it all sort of culminated with I testified at Winter Soldier, the second Winter Soldier in 2008 up in Silver Spring, Maryland at the National Labor College.
Mm-hmm. I covered the first Winter Soldier in Detroit.
Wow, okay, yeah. So Scott was there, yeah. And some of those guys are still around and still very active. I did that, and I'm not really active in IVAW anymore. I got to where I was the regional coordinator. I operated out of Gainesville, and we did a lot of things, and eventually I just got to where I got really apathetic with the whole thing, and I didn't want to dwell on the war anymore, and it was really eating me up, and I wanted to get away from the whole anti-war movement, if you can even call it such. I wanted to get away from that whole life, and so I decided to go to Boone, North Carolina, which I thought would get me kind of quietly tucked away. And at that time, I was being denied the GI Bill. Under the old bill, I wasn't eligible because I hadn't served enough time since I got out early as a CO. So I had no plans to go to college. I just knew that there was music up there and that there was a college up there and where there was sort of an Appalachian kind of music thing. And so I went up there in search of the music, really, and was poor and destitute for a couple years, and then all of a sudden I'm eligible for the new GI Bill. So now I'm in school studying archaeology.
Well, you started playing the banjo, and we're playing the banjo over in Iraq, right?
Yeah, I did. That's right about the time when we got sent back into the war zone. That's when I said, to hell with this, and I got a hold of a music catalog, and I ordered a cheap banjo and had it mailed out to me, and I had no expectations of ever getting it back, but back to the States or anything like that, but I had it mailed out to me out there, and that was nice. I hadn't touched a banjo, I hadn't played any music in 8 months. I'd never stopped singing. I would be up in the gun hatch and singing gospel songs and old, just any kind of old song I could think. And it's something comforting. I'm not religious, but I sort of felt like, nobody would shoot a guy who was just up there singing, So I got the banjo sent out to me, and, we were real bored out there. There's nothing to do. You can play cards, play dominoes. We got ceiling fans installed in our barracks, and the big pastime was to turn a ceiling fan on high, which was way too fast, and throw stuff into it. And that was a lot of fun. So when I got a banjo, this was like, this was like a Broadway musical or something.
And so are you both making a living as a musician and also going to school now?
Well, the GI Bill keeps me pretty fat and happy. Thank God I do still get some compensation from the VA for hearing loss and post-traumatic stress, which I thank them for profusely.
And are you playing in North Carolina? Is that where Appalachian State University is?
That's App State. That's where I
go. So you're performing there, and now you're performing here at the second annual Brooklyn Folk Festival.
Yeah, down in Boone, I pretty much, in the warm months, I'll go out on King Street is the main street in Boone, and you can actually turn a pretty good living if you just go out there and play music. You make about $80 in 4 hours if you sing real loud.
It's better than practicing law.
Yeah, so I'm able to
get not as good as a plumber.
In the summertime, you can live large. Winters are thin around there. Yeah, but yeah, that's basically what I do. I play on the street in the summertime and I get quite a few tips. And I don't really perform a lot on stage, but it's exciting to come up here. Eli, the guy who's Eli Smith, who's organizing all this and doing a fine job, invited me to come up. He came down to Boone for the Black Banjo Gathering, which happened a couple months ago, and that's when I met Eli face-to-face, and he invited me to come up here, probably not thinking that I actually would, and I did. Here I am.
Well, I can tell you, he was hoping you would. Cliff Hicks, you've got a couple of songs about the experiences of soldiers in war. Would you mind sharing them with the audience of Law & Disorder?
Yeah, I'll have to retune. Thank you.
people, whomever you may be. I hope you'll pay attention and listen on to me. Well, I joined that army grand. We left old Kentucky and we sailed to a foreign land. Our captain, he informed us, and I'm sure he thought it right. Before the morning comes, boys, well, I'm sure you'll have to fight. Thank you.
sun, it was a setting. All across that bloody plain, now all of us was wounded, our noble captain slain. And then I thought of mother, who asked me for to stay. Strangers and sail so far away. Well, I've been in the midst of battle. I know its harshness well. I've been across that great ocean, and I've rode down streets of hell. I've lived a life of misery, and I've been where death he roams. I'll tell you from experience, boy, stay at home.
That was Clifton Hicks, who knows what he's singing about. Spent many months over in Iraq, and he's now here at the Brooklyn Folk Festival playing the banjo and singing a song about a soldier's experience in World War I. Could sing the same song about Iraq and Afghanistan. Cliff Hicks, do you have any further thoughts before we close off the interview?
Well, I don't know what to say. I'm kind of zoned out after playing, but thank you, Mike, for having me on your show. And I've enjoyed my time in Brooklyn this week, and let's hope that we can get these ridiculous wars ended and quit killing each other and get our people back home where they belong.
Thanks, Clifton Hickson. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
All right, this is called Brother Green. I'm going to try to do this. Thank you.
Tell my wife she must not grieve. Go kiss my dear.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.